The following article from our Knowing and Doing Quarterly Journal is brought to you by the C.S. Lewis Institute. Our prayer is that this talk will help to deepen your faith and draw you closer to God.
Is the Content of the Biblical Manuscripts Reliable? By Dr. Amy Orr Ewing, Director of Programs of the Oxford Center for Christian Apologetics. Reprinted by permission from her book, Is the Bible Intolerant? This article originally appeared in the winter 2006 issue of Knowing and Doing. It may well come as a shock to some that the manuscript tradition of the Old and New Testaments stands up to rigorous scrutiny. There is a widespread belief that much of the Bible was written centuries after the events it records, and that it has been changed and tampered with on the whim of different scribes or interested parties. The breadth and age of the existing ancient manuscripts tells a very different story. However, this next question invariably follows. Just because the manuscripts are reliable, that doesn't make the content of them true. Indeed, it is true that no one argues for the historicity of Homer's mythology, for example. The manuscripts of his writings may be reasonably intact, but that does not make what he was writing about reliable or accurate historical material. Aren't the Gospels on the same kind of level? Aren't they just mythological, with true moral value, but very little historical reality? Surely accounts involving people walking on water and water turning into wine weren't meant to be taken as historically true. It's all mythology, isn't it? These questions are all very important, and it is true that the Christian must not assume that an unbeliever will accept the content of the biblical text as true simply because the manuscripts themselves have proven to be so trustworthy. There are a number of questions tied up here. The first issue has to do with our approach to the supernatural world. It is probably true to say that our postmodern society is much more open to the possibility of a supernatural realm than was the Enlightenment modernist worldview of previous generations. However, skepticism about these things does still exist in some portions of the population, and it is important for us to deal with the underlying reasons for this. Skepticism about the supernatural world. One possible reason for disbelieving the content of the Gospels and the rest of the Bible is its recording of powerful, miraculous events. What is the cause of this disbelief? Is the person assuming a framework in which miracles are a logical impossibility? Has this individual closed their mind to the possibility of miracles and supernatural occurrences? Do they believe only in the natural world and things which are scientifically provable? This skepticism is based on the ideas of the philosopher David Hume, 1711 through 1776. He argued that all objects of human inquiry are either, quote, relations of ideas, end quote, that is, mathematical statements and definitions, or, quote, matters of fact, end quote, that is, everything which can be known and tested empirically. Hume wrote, quote, when we run over libraries, persuaded of these principles, what havoc must we make? If we take in our hand any volume of divinity or school metaphysics, for instance, let us ask, does it contain any abstract reasoning concerning quantity or number? No. Does it contain any experimental reasoning concerning matter of fact and existence? No. Commit it then to the flames, for it can contain nothing but sophistry and illusion. End quote. However, there are serious problems with this position. The main one is that Hume's philosophy fails its own test, because his own statement fits into neither of his categories. As Norman Geisler comments, quote, the statement that, quote, only analytic or empirical propositions are meaningful, end quote, is not in itself an analytic, true by definition, or empirical statement. Hence, by its own criteria, it is meaningless, end quote. C.S. Lewis deals with this kind of materialist approach in his usual lucid manner, showing that a dogmatic commitment to this philosophy makes thinking itself problematic. Quote, it follows that no account of the universe can be true unless that account leaves it possible for our thinking to be a real insight. A theory which explained everything else in the whole universe, but which made it impossible to believe that our thinking was valid, would be utterly out of court. For that theory would itself have been reached by thinking. Thus, a strict materialism refutes itself for the reasons given long ago by Professor Haldane, who said, if my mental processes are determined wholly by the motions of atoms in my brain, I have no reason to suppose that my beliefs are true, and hence I have no reason for supposing my brain to be composed of atoms. End quote. This kind of passionate commitment to a purely material world and the non-possibility of miraculous interventions from outside is problematic. For the materialist, thinking itself becomes a process which falls outside the remit of that which has capacity for meaning. The motivation for denying the possible existence of a supernatural realm often seems to be strong, even to the point of demonstrating prejudice. One writer, who comes from a materialist viewpoint, considers this phenomenon. Quote, it is not that the methods and institutions of science somehow to compel us to accept a material explanation of the phenomenal world, but, on the contrary, that we are forced by our a priori adherence to material causes to create an apparatus of investigation and a set of concepts that produce material explanations, no matter how counterintuitive, no matter how mystifying to the uninitiated. Moreover, that materialism is an absolute, for we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. End quote. A commitment to the modernist worldview, in which there is nothing other than the empirically testable world around us, means that everything else is seen through a materialist lens, although this lens is, of course, not acknowledged and does not even pass its own test. This kind of a priori commitment to the falseness of the Gospels and the non-possibility of any miraculous occurrence is a form of closed-mindedness. The basis on which these views are held, that is, philosophical materialism, is not itself logically consistent and deserves to be challenged. Materialists need to be encouraged to at least be open to the possibility of the supernatural, even if they remain extremely skeptical. To be closed to this possibility is to claim absolute knowledge of the universe, an astounding godlike claim. New Testament miracles. It may be interesting for a skeptic to look at the context of the New Testament miracles. Many of the men and women involved were fishermen or tax collectors, certainly down-to-earth types. We read that when Jesus walked on water, they were frightened. This is an ordinary reaction to a supernatural event. It is a response that rings true. The reader is being told about these events with the acknowledgement that they are unusual. We are expected to be surprised that these things happened. We read that when Joseph discovered that Mary was pregnant, he wanted to send her away. Again, this is a normal human reaction. He assumes a natural reason for the pregnancy and is himself convinced otherwise only by a supernatural experience. For a person who is skeptical about the possibility of the miraculous, it may be important to read a gospel themselves. Many people who have this outlook have never really picked up a gospel and read it. They may expect it to be a story full of goblins and fairies, not the down-to-earth but marvelous writing that it is. intentional deception? Just because the manuscript tradition is well attested does not mean that the content contained within it is truthful. While the manuscripts may be genuine ancient copies, leaving no room for a hoax, this does not mean that what is written in them is not an attempt at deception. This question may be phrased along the following lines. Quote, "The stories were all invented by the writers as a deliberate attempt to inspire followers and to exonerate the disciples' decision to follow this man Jesus. He didn't ever want to found a religion, but his followers did." End quote. There are a number of ways of answering this question. 1. Why would the disciples portray themselves in a bad light? For example, Peter's denial, their slowness to understand Jesus' teaching, or their lack of faith. 2. Why is there so much in the New Testament about the cost of Christianity? Surely they would have given it up after all the suffering, if it was a deception. 3. Why would they be willing to be killed for their teachings? For example, Peter was crucified upside down, and Thomas was torn in half. As John Stott says, quote, "If anything is clear from the Gospels and the Acts, it is that the apostles were sincere. They may have been deceived, if you like, but they were not deceivers. Hypocrites and martyrs are not made of the same stuff." End quote. Is the New Testament comprehensible? We should remember that many people today have the idea that the Bible is gobbledygook. However, a comparison between the scriptures and rival literature shows the coherence of the Gospels. Let us take a section of the apocryphal Gospel of Thomas as an example. Quote, "Jesus said, I have cast fire on the world, and behold, I guard it until it blazes. Jesus said, this heaven will pass away, and that which is above it will pass away, and the dead were not alive, and the living will not die. In the days when you ate what is dead, you made it alive. When you come into the light, what will you do? On the day when you were one, you became two. But when you have become two, what will you do?" End quote. The straightforward style of the New Testament Gospels is in stark contrast to this rambling alternative. Even Jesus' more apocryphal statements contained in the New Testament Gospels have a coherence and a comprehensive style which is notably lacking here. Other ancient literature. Skeptics would be surprised by the number of extra-biblical writings which refer to events and places mentioned by the writers of the Bible. These writings come from a variety of perspectives and backgrounds, demonstrating that at least some of the content of the Bible is credible to the skeptic. Josephus. Josephus was born in A.D. 37 into a Jewish family, and he joined the Pharisaic party at the age of 19. He settled in Rome, where he lived under the name of Flavius Josephus. He wrote prolifically, and it is in the pages of his books, History of the Jewish War and Antiquities of the Jewish People, that we come across various references to biblical characters, places, and events. He mentions, 1. Figures from the New Testament, the Herods, Pilate, Felix, Festus, the procurators of Judea, the high priestly families of Annas, Caiaphas, and Ananias. All these people are referred to by Josephus. He also mentions Judas the Galilean, who led an uprising. See Acts 5:37. And at another point, quote, "James, the brother of the so-called Christ," end quote. 2. Events mentioned by the New Testament. The famine in the days of Claudius. See Acts 11:28. 3. the crucifixion of Jesus. Josephus writes, quote, "And there arose about this time Jesus, a wise man, if indeed we should call him a man, for he was a doer of marvelous deeds, a teacher of men who received the truth with pleasure. He led away many Jews, and also many of the Greeks. This man was the Christ. And when Pilate had condemned him to the cross on his impeachment by the chief men among us, those who had loved him at first did not cease, for he appeared to them on the third day alive again, the divine prophets having spoken these and thousands of other wonderful things about him, and even now the tribe of Christians, so named after him, has not yet died out." End quote. This passage is controversial and should be handled with care, as many scholars have argued that it is a later interpolation by Christians trying to prove something about Jesus. It is dismissed on the grounds that Josephus, a Jew, would not have written so positively about the Christian claims about Jesus. However, other scholars argue that the earliest copies of Josephus contain this paragraph, and so, if this is an interpolation, a lot more of his writings must be held in question. These scholars also argue that Josephus is speaking in jest and is mocking those who believe in Jesus, and that the overall tone of the passage is heavy with irony and scorn. If this is the case, it is a useful historical document which mentions the bare facts of Christian belief about Jesus, the historical person, and as such deserves our attention. Thallus. Thallus wrote a work tracing the history of Greece and its relations with Asia from the time of the Trojan War to his own day, A.D. 52. Thallus has written about the darkness over the land following Christ's crucifixion, and had tried to dismiss the darkness as being of no religious importance. But, by trying to dismiss it, he gives us a historical reference to it. None of his own manuscripts survive, but he is referred to by Julius Africanus in A.D. 221. Quote, "Thallus, in the third book of his histories, explains away this darkness as an eclipse of the sun, unreasonably, it seems to me." End quote. Unreasonably, because it was Passover, and hence the time of the full moon. Tacitus. Tacitus wrote a history of Rome around A.D. 110. When recording the time of Nero, he wrote about that emperor's horrific decision to burn Rome down. Quote, "Therefore, to scotch the rumor, Nero substituted as culprits and punished with the utmost refinements of cruelty a class of men loathed for their vices, whom the crowd styled Christians. Christus, from whom they got their name, had been executed by sentence of the procurator Pontius Pilate when Tiberius was emperor, and the pernicious superstition was checked for a short time, only to break out afresh, not only in Judea, the home of the plague, but in Rome itself, where all the horrible and shameful things in the world collect and find a home." End quote. Here we have brief but credible references to the basic facts concerning the death of Christ under Pontius Pilate. Suetonius. Suetonius wrote biographies of the first 12 Caesars. In his Life of Nero, he writes, quote, "Punishment was inflicted on the Christians, a class of men addicted to a novel and mischievous superstition." End quote. In his Life of Claudius, he says, quote, "As the Jews were making constant disturbances at the instigation of Christus, he expelled them from Rome." End quote. Plinius Secundus, Pliny the Younger. Pliny was governor of Bithynia in Asia Minor from A.D. 111 to A.D. 113, and he wrote a number of letters to the Emperor Trajan during these 2 years. In one of these letters, he asked for advice on how to deal with Christians. Quote, "They were in the habit of meeting on a certain fixed day before it was light, when they sang an anthem to Christ as God and bound themselves by a solemn oath not to commit any wicked deed, but to abstain from all fraud, theft, and adultery, never to break their word or deny a trust when called upon to honor it, after which it was their custom to separate, and then meet again to partake of food, but food of an ordinary kind." End quote. Has the Bible been changed in transmission? So we have seen a few examples of extra-biblical historical writers making reference to biblical events and lending credence to the accuracy of those events. Another question which often follows on from this one, for example, about the reliability of the content of the biblical record, concerns whether the Bible has been tampered with by different copyists. Some people have an image in their minds of many generations of scribes reproducing the biblical manuscripts for distribution, and each generation adding its own changes, so that what we have now bears little resemblance to the original and cannot be trusted. However, the reality is that the textual variants that do exist are mostly single letters or grammatical differences. Our modern translations are extremely forthcoming at mentioning these minor differences. They are not hidden away, but clearly noted and referenced in the margins and footnotes on each page. When we bear in mind that we are talking about large numbers of ancient, hand-copied manuscripts, around 24,000 manuscript copies for the New Testament alone, the Bible we have today is astoundingly free from questions. The scholar Norman Geisler comments, quote, "Only about 1/8 of all the variants had any weight, as most of them were merely mechanical matters, such as spelling or style. Of the whole, then, only about 1/60 rise above trivialities, or can in any sense be called substantial variations." End quote. The Talmudists. The Old Testament text is similarly robust. The Talmudists reproduced Old Testament manuscripts between AD 270 and AD 500. They were religious scholars who commented on and explained the Old Testament to the Jewish community. They had an intricate set of regulations which they followed in order to ensure the integrity of the manuscripts they were producing. The Masoretes. The Masoretes took on the laborious job of editing and standardizing the Old Testament text between AD 500 and AD 900, working from the manuscripts that were available to them. F.F. Bruce writes, quote, "With the greatest imaginable reverence, they devised a complicated system of safeguard against scribal slips. They counted, for example, the number of times each letter of the alphabet occurs in each book. They pointed out the middle letter of the Pentateuch and the middle letter of the whole Hebrew Bible, and made even more detailed calculations than these." End quote. This kind of respect for the integrity of the text is important for us to remember if we are to gain a true picture of how the Bible has been transmitted from ancient times until today. Popular images of ancient scribes making things up as they went along and changing texts at will are a travesty of what actually happened. The motivation of those who transmitted the texts was that successive generations would be able to find truth for themselves in the pages of Scripture. The integrity of the content of Scripture was of paramount importance to them. We now have to make our own minds up about whether that content is actually true or not. But to hide behind an idea that it has been corrupted and changed in transmission is a little disingenuous.
Thank you for listening. The C.S. Lewis Institute endeavors to develop disciples who will articulate, defend, and live their faith in Christ in personal and public life. This takes the form of discipleship programs, area-wide conferences and seminars, pastor fellowships, and resources in print and on the web. For more information about the C.S. Lewis Institute, or to support this ministry, please visit our website at www.cslewisinstitute.org.